Okay, well, we're going to get started here because I know you all came to listen to Tom for 55 minutes. As he's reminding Dr. Swish of all the shots of his he blocked all the time. I don't want to try and tell any golf jokes because I'm sure, Tom, you've heard every one of them, but I do want to share a couple of stories that you, I'm sure, do not remember. Back in 1981, I was at the recreation department here in town, and a young, I think about a senior in college, junior in college maybe, came to open gym. And it was 50 cents to play all day. Tom says, "Lee, I'm a broke college student. I don't have 50 cents. So then I kind of went, "Well, come on, Tom." And he says, "Well, I'll tell you what, Lee. Next time I come, I'll give a dollar to open gym." So 36 years later, I still haven't seen that dollar. I can. Hey, where's the interest? The other little, thank you, Tom. We'll leave this as a speaker fee, okay? The other story I wanted to tell you about is I'm on record back in the, I won't tell you, the 70s, that we've shared it with Tom, and I teased him, and I'm on record that the only guys that went out for golf were those that couldn't make the baseball team. Well, Tom, I'm here to apologize because I think the golf thing worked out a lot better than baseball would have. Okay. Tom is a Christian professional golfer here from the Alexandria area. He has 37 tournament wins, including a spectacular 1996 Open Championship and a PGA Tour Championship. He's the only golfer in history to have been awarded the Player of the Year in three different PGA Tours, the regular PGA Tour, the Web.com Tour, and the Senior PGA Tour of Champions. Tom doesn't cite these accomplishments as the most important milestone in his life. He says that what took place when he accepted Jesus Christ into his life to fill that void that golf couldn't fill is that event. Now the freedom of knowing that God loves him no matter what happens on the green or on the course has propelled him through a long and impressive career. Tom's accomplishments extend well off the course. He serves on the board of Elevate Phoenix, a civic program providing long-term, life-changing relationships with urban youth. He's also involved with Courtney's Place, Mackenzie Monks Foundation, Hope Kids, Children's Cancer Research, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, just to name a few. In 2007, he was awarded the Byron Nelson Prize, which is given to a person or organization in the golf world who exemplifies the ideals of giving back that Byron Nelson personified. Layman Tom says he could never accomplish and been successful in professional golf without the support of his wife, Melissa, and his four children and his family. In his spare time, he enjoys fly fishing, golf course design, hunting, and sports. So if you could give us a warm Alexandria welcome to the pride of Alexandria.
Well, thank you. You know, I was listening to what you were saying, that I enjoy fly fishing, golf course design, and sports. I'm pretty one-dimensional. I think it's all about sports for me. It's like, but I was raised in a family where the dad was all about sports, and so, you know, he was my hero, so I took after him, and I'm a sports guy through and through. But anyway, it's great to be here. I'm thankful to be here. Lee, thank you for the nice little lead in there. Seeing you brings back so many good memories. We have so many amazing people in Alexandria, and I've got old classmates over here and classmates over there and friends I've known forever, old fat pastor friends. And, you know, I saw somebody that I think I said the wrong thing. I was talking with him with another pastor friend of his, and I said, "Jody, we broke more rules pheasant hunting than you can shake a stick at." And I probably shouldn't have said that in front of the other pastor, but it's kind of true. I remember one year, I used to love to go pheasant hunting, especially when it was snowing. And one year, it was a real snowy Thanksgiving morning, and so I decided I was going to go out by myself. And, you know how it is. You're 18 years old, and you've got a car, and you've got a dog, and you've got a shotgun, and you find a couple pheasants, and boom, boom, they get up. You shoot two pheasants, which is the limit. But then the third one gets up, boom, you shoot that one too. Then the fourth, then the fifth, then the sixth. And before you know it, you're home with a whole trunk full of pheasants. And my dad's like, oh, my gosh, they could take away my car. This is not your car. This is my car. They're gonna confiscate my car because you shot 10 pheasants today. Sorry, Dad, I didn't know. Anyway, it's great to be here. I do have a couple of stories to tell, and I'll start with one of my favorite. I know I've spoke here before. I don't know if anybody has ever been to somewhere where I speak. So if I give you the same old stories and jokes, please put up with me. It's just they're good stories and jokes, so I tell them a lot. Yeah. But one of my favorite golf stories ever had to do with my wife. And my wife, who is not here, she's in town, but she couldn't make it today. She is not a golfer. For those of you who know her will attest to the fact that she is a very accomplished person, but she cannot count golf as one of her many accomplishments. I mean, she is awful. When I say bad, I mean really bad. Her idea is that it matters way more to me to look good in the golf course than actually to play well. So, and she gets that part right, but she doesn't get the golf part right. So we're playing in this mixed team tournament, an alternate shot mixed team golf tournament down in Arizona. An alternate shot is exactly as it sounds. Is I hit the first one, she hits the second one, I hit the third one, she hits the fourth one until you finish the hole. It's alternate shot, and it's a club tournament against all your buddies, and so you want to do well. And so we get up on the first hole, and I hit the tee shot right down the middle, typical 275, 280. And she gets to the second shot, and Arizona is all about desert, right? And so she takes whatever club she hit, and she kind of just skittles it off to the right into the edge of the desert. And so I kind of get in the edge of the desert, and a little, cactus bush or whatever it was, and I hack it out from there onto the green about 15 feet from the hole. I mean, it was actually a heck of a good recovery. And putting probably is the worst part of her game. So she gets up on this putt, and she hits this 15-foot putt 20 feet by. And then I get up on the 20-footer, and I make it for a 5. All right, and so we've survived the hole with a bogey, but now I must have been mumbling or grumbling because we're going to the next tee, and she's like, well, what's your problem? I go, well, you're kind of mumbling. What's the problem? I go, hey, if we want to win, if you want to beat all your buddies, we got to do better than 5s on easy par 4s. And she says, hey, that's not my fault. You took 3 shots. I only took 2. So all of you men out here, think about how many fights in the history of our marriage I've won against a person who thinks that quickly. I'm oh for the world when it comes to that. Even when I'm right, I'm wrong. But anyway, that's just one of my favorite. There's a lot of things about golf which are interesting. There's a guy named Simon Hobday. Think about golf stories, and there's this guy named Simon Hobday who's from South Africa. The first time I met him, is like the guy's like a pirate. He just has this larger-than-life personality, and he just, all he talks about is parties and drinking and women and just, the list goes on. I mean, every vice you can have, this guy had them. But a character of all characters. And so he was playing in this tournament on the PGA Tour, and he didn't like where his ball was. His ball ended up in some spot where he thought he maybe should get a free drop. I need to get relief from here. For what reason, Simon? Well, because, I'm, standing on a sprinkler head, trying to hit the ball, no, you don't get relief. No relief. You got to hit it from there. So he was really upset with the official. So he said to the guy, he says, hey, if I called you a blankety, 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 blank, he used all the words, by the way. If I called you a blankety, 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 blank, would I be penalized? He goes, absolutely, you'd be penalized and fined. He says, well, if I just thought you were a blankety, 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 blank, would I be penalized? He goes, well, no, you can think whatever you want to, Simon. He goes, okay, good, I think you're a blankety, 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 blank. Another quick story about this guy is he was late for a starting time, and he was just flying down this road, in Pima Road in Scottsdale, going about 100, in a 40. And there's a speed trap. A cop was up ahead. They pull him over, and the cop walks up to the window, and he says, son, you're going mighty fast. You're going really, really fast on this road. He goes, sir, I got here as fast as I could. another fast thinking guy. But you know, golf stories. You know, and we're going to talk about other stuff too. But you know, people like to hear about stories. And you know, I have a couple of favorites. A couple of my favorite stories personally. I did something, like I've done a couple things that I've never been done before in golf, which I won't talk about, you know, but, you know, it's always nice when you do things that have never been done before. You know, Lee mentioned that I was the only player to ever win Player of the Year on the PGA Tour, the Champions Tour, the Web.com, which is like, you know, that's a cool thing. When nobody else has done that, you kind of feel good about that accomplishment. Well, I did something else at the U.S. Open at Bethpage back in about 2003, which I guarantee has never been done before. Happened on the fifth hole. A par four, you tee off up on a hill, and the fairway kind of goes off on an angle like this with a big bunker on the right. And depending upon how good you feel with the driver, you cut off, you know, this much of the bunker or that much of the bunker, or you maybe just take it over the entire bunker trying to shorten up this long par four. And so I was really hitting it well, and so I just took it over everything and just roasted this tee shot over right, just right over the top of the far right side of the bunker. But I kind of pushed it just a little bit, and that may catch the rough, you know. I mean, it was probably going to be in the edge of the rough, and I was kind of concerned about it because, you know, the rough in the U.S. Open is always real thick, and if you hit in the rough, it's usually always a bogey. So you're kind of uncertain, you know, and I'm walking up there looking ahead, you know, trying to see where the marshal is, and didn't see a marshal in the edge of the rough, and I'm thinking, like, well, where might have that ball gone? You know, I can't see where anybody's marking where that ball was. It's not in the fairway. Don't see a guy in the rough. And I go marching past this bunker looking ahead, and they all start yelling, hey, your ball is back there. And I turn around, and you know, the bunker is here, and the back end of the bunker comes down like that, and the green is that way. My ball is kind of halfway up the hill, you know, on a stance about like this, kind of underneath the grass. And I'm thinking to myself, well, if you're hitting it this way, how does your ball get underneath the grass that way? You know, and as it turns out, it hit a guy in the shin over in the crowd, and it bounced backwards up into the spot. So now I'm like, well, are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. He's got a big welt on his leg. I go, well, if you're okay, then, you know, what the heck are you doing putting me right there? You know, thanks a lot for that. You know, because where the gallery steps and walks, it's all trampled down. I got to hit a driver off of there. But now I've got to just hack it out to the fairway. And so I take out the sand wedge, and I've got this really awkward stance. You know, I've got one leg that's way up in the air like this, and, you know, trying to just hack it to the fairway. But I realize as I get over this ball that the grass is so thick and it's so awkward that I've got to swing really, really hard just to hit it 40 yards back to where the fairway is. And as I take these practice swings, you know, and the crowd is kind of right here where Joe is. I mean, the crowd is that close. And they all start kind of backing away. You know, I'm aiming this way. They're over here, and they start backing away. And so I'm like, I stop and go, well, where are you guys going? And there's a New York crowd. You know, Bethpage is in New York, and of course, some New Yorker goes, hey, you're probably going to shank it. You know, and for those of you who don't play golf, a shank is when you're aiming this way and the ball goes straight that way. I said, hey, don't worry, you know, and, you know, I haven't shanked a shot in 25 years, maybe never. I'm not sure if I've ever shanked a shot. I mean, I just don't do that. You're all okay, and they all move right back in close. And so I get here, and I take this big swing as hard as I can just to hit it 40 yards. And what do? I shank it. And it hit the very same guy in the chest. The same guy, twice on one hole. I promise you, it's never been done before. Have you ever heard that? Dr. Swish, you ever heard that?
No.
Lee, you ever heard that?
Nope,
that's a first. I guarantee that's a first. You know, people talk about the British Open that I won, and of course that was a really great week. Winning the British Open was fantastic. A lot of great memories. I was there with my dad, and I mean, I could tell stories about that trip. In fact, I'll divert for a second. We went a few days early, and I mean, many of you remember my dad. My dad was one of the world's great guys. Smoked that pipe, you know. So we went to play golf at this place called Sunningdale, and while we're there, we run into this guy named Peter Lopez, who was Glenn Frey's manager. And I had known him for a few years and had known Glenn through Peter Lopez. And so, you know, like, Peter, you know, London, you know, Sunningdale, what are you doing here? He goes, oh, the Eagles just got back and they're just going on the road with the Hell Freezes Over tour. You know, it's the big reunion tour for the Eagles, and they're playing at Wembley Stadium the next three nights. Do you want to go? Wow. you know, I've got, well, of course I want to go, but, you know, my dad, you know, I'm not sure if he wants to go. So I, let me ask my dad and I'll call you. So I, hey, Dad, you want to go to the Eagles? He goes, oh, I'd love to go see the Eagles. Who are they? So I say, well, you know, they're maybe the world's greatest rock band ever almost. You know, maybe not the greatest, but certainly top five. In that Wembley Stadium, you know, 85,000 people. I mean, it'll be so much fun. Let's go. Oh, yeah, okay, we'll do it. So we go. All right. And so, I mean, how many folks have been to a rock concert? Okay, so after you get beyond the first song or two, what's the pervasive smell in the air at a rock concert? And so I thought, you know, I'm going to get my dad really good. Dad, what? Can I use your pipe? What for? He goes, oh, we got some really good weed. We're going to smoke some weed. You want to smoke some weed, Dad? Huh? We're going to light up your pipe and we're going to smoke some pot right here in the 10th row in front of the Eagles. Okay, you want to do that? Oh, Tom, you know, you're not serious, are you? Oh, dead serious, Dad. We're going to light it up. Jamie, you got the stuff? Okay, we had him going. Okay, and he was like, no, you can't have my pipe. I go, oh, Dad, I haven't smoked pot in my entire life, not once. I'm not going to do it now. So we kind of got him going. So when I think about that British Open, that's how the week started. So I end up going out and I win the tournament. And so the whole week long, I had this policeman who was assigned to me. This guy, a big, tall Lancashire constable, his name was Kevin Boyles. And he looks just like you'd imagine. You know, he's about 6'4", his shoulders are this wide, just this big, young, strong guy, and he was assigned to be my protector or whatever for the week. The minute I got there Monday, it's like, here's Kevin, he's your guy. Everywhere you go, he goes. Okay, I was at the time ranked number 2 in the world, so I guess they assigned these guys to all the top players, and so he was my guy. And so everywhere I went, he went. Inside the ropes, outside the ropes, the press room, players' lounge, you know, whatever, me and Kevin. So finally on the 72nd hole, as you know if you watch the tournament, once you hit the second shot to the green, the crowd all rushes forward and there's, you know, from this end of this building to that end of the building, people trying to get to the 18th green, and then you have to get through the crowd from this end to that end. I mean, the player is behind, and you've got to fight your way all the way through to get to the green. So I had Kevin Boyles in front of me, had one arm around him, I guess, holding onto me, and the other arm, he's just sweeping people to the side. just imagine like a machine, just people flying, you know, he's just creating this pathway all the way to the green, and we finally break through, and there's the green, and we kind of step out into the open, the crowd's going crazy, and he puts his arm around me, and I'm going to have to use a bad word, I apologize, and he says, "Hey, Tom, we've been through a lot of shit together, but now you're on your own." And he pushes me up onto the green. So, you know, those are the stories that people don't hear about, but those are the things that, you know, make golf most special to me is, you know, memories like that, you know, and they're very, very, very fond memories. You know, getting back to Alexandria, I mean, I think anyone who is my age can probably testify that there was probably no place in America that was better to grow up than this city, than this town. And a remarkable group of people, amazing parents, amazing teachers, amazing, you know, administrators in the schools, amazing, just, you know, pastors, just an atmosphere that really encouraged people, I think, to do the right thing, to have a faith in God, to use that faith in God and translate that into doing the right thing. And I see the Leslies here, and, you know, their son Jeff was like the leader of the band, you know. So when I think about growing up here, you know, Ed and Sylvia opened their home with FCA, and Ed was a football coach, and guys would go to FCA because they wanted to be the starting quarterback. I don't know. Just kidding. But you know, he was the leader. He was the leader of the FCA, and it was important to him, and he led the kids, and he was the guy who kind of inspired the kids to want to become more. And then these young guys who were, you know, under him, you know, Jeff and Rod Ripperger and Kevin Donatel and some of these guys who are a year older than me, you know, became real leaders, you know, in the school and really kind of rallied everybody around them to take part. To the point, I think, where we would have, you guys can tell me, we would have 100 or 150 or 200 kids maybe in somebody's house, you know, for an FCA meeting every week. at Ed's house or somewhere else. I mean, there was this amazing, I think, outpouring of God's Spirit, I would say, in this city amongst the young people to really inspire these young kids to take their faith seriously. And they had a bunch of young guys who really did take it seriously, and it inspired younger guys like me to want that as well. You know, so I can honestly say that my life was transformed as a 15-year-old, first of all, you know, by the love and the grace and the mercy that God has for us through Jesus, you know, and then that being displayed to me personally by people around me, starting with kids nearly my age and then adults who really lived it. And I think that's really the issue. The issue is, you know, living it. You know, what does it look like to live it? You know, when you think about living a life that reflects the love of God, the love and the mercy of Jesus, what exactly does that look like? And I spoke at a thing at a school down in Phoenix, and this school's motto was an all-boys school, Brophy High School, was men for others. And I have kind of, in some ways, adopted that thought, you know, men for others, you know, a servant is there for others. Men for others, meaning leading by serving. And it's kind of what I see in my life around me of what it looks like. What does it look like to have a life controlled by Jesus? And so I have a few people I want to talk about. The first one was I had a caddy for 22 years named Andrew Martinez. Andrew Martinez was a guy whose parents grew up in Mexico. They immigrated to the States. He's first-generation American. I met him because I was playing in the Mexican Open, and we're in the lobby of the hotel, and he was caddying for John Cook at the time, and we're in this hotel down in Mexico City, and this guy is just, you know, going at me in Espanol, just 100 miles an hour. I have no idea what he's saying, and Andrew, who I don't know at all, but I know who he is, he's this world-famous caddy, and he's Mexican-American. I turn to him and say, Andrew, what's he saying to me? He's like, I don't speak Spanish. I have no idea. Like, well, what kind of a Mexican-American are you? And that's how I met the guy. You know, it's like, really? You don't speak Spanish? No, don't speak Spanish. Okay. You can caddy, though. So anyway, so we, from that point, kind of developed this friendship, and then he started caddying for me starting in 1992, 1993 maybe, one or the other. And he caddied for 22 years, really until a year and a half ago. So almost 23 years of this guy caddying for me. And, you know, he would say, you know, what do you require in a golfer? And he would say, you got to have the three P's. You got to be able to play, you got to be able to pray, and you got to be able to play, pray, and pay. Most importantly, you got to pay. But for Andrew, actually, the most important thing was to pray. You know, he told me from the very beginning, if you ever do anything that messes up your marriage, that is unfaithful to your wife, that messes up your kids, I will not work for you. I'll be done. You know, I'm going to hold you accountable to be the man who you claim to be. You know, and so for 22 years, other than just being a caddy, he was also a dear friend. He was a guy who held me accountable. I can't tell you the number of times, because, I mean, those of you who know me, who knew me growing up, can attest to the fact that I had quite a temper. And I was not beyond throwing clubs, slamming trees, chopping down bushes, you know, you name it, yelling, screaming, swearing. I mean, I can tell you many, many stories, you know, about my temper, how it would get the best of me, and how I really, and quite frankly, people say, how can you be a Christian if you act like that? Go, look, the reason I am is because I do act like that. You know, I need to be forgiven. You know I need to be forgiven, because anybody who can do that needs forgiveness. That's me, you know. So this caddy, Andrew, he says, like, I'm going to hold you accountable. And so we developed this friendship and this relationship, which is based almost entirely on the fact that we are Christian brothers, and he was a caddy, and I was a player, and we were going to be probably as good as we could for each other. So this whole idea about, you know, men for others, here's what I say about Andrew. He would tell me, my whole purpose in life, professionally, is to make you look good. I'm here to serve you. I'm here to do whatever it takes for you to look good. And so I commit to you that no matter what the place, no matter what position we are in a golf tournament, no matter what tournament it might be, I don't care if we're first or last, whether we're playing in the Quad Cities or the U.S. Open, you have my word that I will do my very, very best to make you look good. And so, and here's how it all worked out then, and how he was such a man for others, such a man who was a servant for others. The British Open that I did win, the first round I was 4 under par through 12 holes. Having a really good day, I was playing really well going in. I just finished second in the US Open, so my game was good, and I was 4 under through 12, leading the tournament in the first round early. Got to 13, the easiest hole in the golf course, literally a 5-iron and a sand wedge, and I made a 6, made a double bogey. So I go from 4 under to 2 under on the easiest hole in the course. Now I had to play the 5 hardest holes on the course. And so, I mean, to say that I was angry, you know, would be a afterthought, I mean, an understatement. I mean, I was so mad. I mean, I could have, you know, you're looking around and he'd say, look, people are watching. People are watching. Don't do it. People are watching you. Don't do it. People are watching. I mean, that's literally, you know, I got the driver and I'm flexing the driver, you know, just, you know, and just hit this tee shot. The next hole just wasn't even thinking about the bunkers or the grass, just hitting it as hard as I could down the middle because I was so mad, and just right down the middle. And 6-iron, you know, where's the flag? I don't care where the trouble is. 6-iron, about 8 feet from the hole, and I'm still just smoking mad. And I get to the green, and I mark my ball, pick it up, and Andrew's across the green. And it's like, you know, it's about a 95-mile fastball right to him. You know, good catch. You know, just smoking mad. And he walks over to me after he cleans the ball, and he holds the ball out, and then he pulls it away. I go, what? And he goes, I just want to tell you something. I go, what? He goes, I just want to say that I'm caddying for the best player in the field. And then he handed the ball back, and then he walked away. Okay, so I'm like, wow. You know, and it reminded me, you know, on a competitive level of, hey, there's nothing to sweat. These guys out here, these guys aren't as good as you. You know, I believe that. He's like, I believe that. Nobody here, Faldo, Norman, Tiger Woods, whomever, is as good as you, and I believe that. So would you please believe it also? And so I made the birdie putt. I birdied the next hole, and I'm shooting 67. And then I went on to win the tournament. And I think it's all because of what he said on the 14th hole that day. As he said, the right thing at the right time. But he, his whole purpose was for me to be my best. His whole life was given to make me my best. And he did it because of his deep belief in God, and God requiring him, he thought, to always give his very best at what he does, no matter who's looking or who's not, you know, and to serve. You know, the life of Jesus is a life of service, is being a servant. And so he served me for 22 years, the best he could possibly serve me, to make me look good, to help me be successful. And to me, that's what it looks like. That's a man for others. That's what living a Christian life looks like. And other things, other people. You know, Jim Flick. Jim Flick was my coach for 23 years. Same thing. I mean, whether it be 100 degrees or 30 degrees, raining, windy, he would sit on that range and he'd watch me hit balls for hours and hours and hours and hours, simply trying to help me to get to that level professionally where I would need to be. And he was a man of faith as well. And just, you know, he died about 4 years ago. It's interesting, on the day before he died, we were playing in the Schwab Championship, and I got to the golf course, and there was Andrew, and there was my other buddy, and they all kind of had their head down, and Jim had been sick, been, you know, very, you know, on his deathbed sick. And the first thing he said was, hey, I'm really sorry about Jim. I go, well, really? Did he die last night? Yeah, he passed away last night. Oh, really? You know, this is like on a Thursday or a Friday or whatever. And so I was, you know, obviously upset. And I went and hit a few putts, and I'm putting in the putter and just thinking about all the years, 23 years of this guy as my coach. And you know, started as a coach, and now he was just a dear friend. And I thought, well, maybe I ought to call his wife and you know, just give him my condolences. Then Andrew and Dennis walked back up and said, hey, before you call, you know, why don't you say a prayer? Let's just say a prayer for Jim, you know. My friend Dennis wanted to say a prayer for Jim. And so I said a prayer right there in the putting green for Jim Flick. And then I called Jerry, his wife, and, you know, hey, Jerry, it's Tom. You know, I'm here. I just heard, oh, no, 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 that's not true. He's here. He wants to talk to you. Whoa, really? He goes, yeah. He said, hold on. And he goes, hey, coach, how are you? Go out there today and, you know, hey, don't listen to those media guys. You know, I'm still here, still going strong. Just you go play well. And so Andrew and my buddy are looking at me, and I finally hang up, and I go, he's still alive. And Dennis says, wow, that was some prayer. But you know, but again, another person who simply had a foundation in his life based upon biblical principle. He loved God. He thought it was our goal or our purpose, goal and purpose in life, to reflect what God has for us in the way we live. And the way he chose to do that was by giving. He gave everything he knew. He gave everything he had to me. You know, and I went from being a guy in the mini tours to ranked number one in the world and being a major champion and a Ryder Cup captain, you know, in a big way because he chose to help me get there. He saw in me the ability to get there, and he chose to want to help me. And so he served me completely, unreservedly, for 23 years. You know, so in my book, that guy is a man for others. That guy is a man who reflects what it means to be a Christian. He worked really hard at what he did because God said, you know, work hard. You have these talents, use them. You know, but beyond that, use them in the right way, serve others. Phil Mickelson, another person. Now, you would never think of Phil Mickelson in the terms you think of maybe as the two guys I just mentioned. But we went through a really tough time in 2001. My wife was pregnant with our fourth child, and after 6.5 months of pregnancy, she delivered a stillborn child. And, you know, a tough time, very difficult for both of us. And those around us knew how distraught we were, how much pain it was causing. You know, we were so excited about, you know, kid number four and you know, in all these plans, and people have been there, done that, so you know what I'm talking about. So it's tough, you know. And so we're home, you know, not long after all that kind of went down, and we're trying to just kind of get our stuff together, you know, when we get this FedEx package in the mail. It's a FedEx letter. You know, I wonder who this is from. And so open up this letter, and it's a letter addressed to Samuel Lehman from Phil Mickelson. And so, you know, well, that's a little bit strange, you know, not strange in a bad way, but just unexpected. You know, I wonder what this letter says. And the letter was simply a letter that Phil wrote to our stillborn child, Samuel. You know, it's telling Samuel what great parents he had, you know, what a great family he was going to have, that we would see him in heaven. I mean, just everything that you would need to say in a letter to make parents feel better, Phil said. And so, you know, he was always a good friend. I could tell a lot of stories that make you laugh too. But this particular thing was when we needed a friend who needed to say the right thing at the right time, Phil Mickelson was there to do that. So when you watch Phil play, and when you watch Phil put his foot in his mouth in the media, and, you know, remember that. That's the Phil Mickelson that we know. You know, he definitely was a man for others. He was there for me. He was there for my wife when we needed him. And that, to me, is what it means to live out your faith. You do things like that because you know people need something, that you need some kind of relief, some kind of encouragement, some kind of a pat in the back. You need to be forgiven. Whatever it might be, he saw the need. He knew we needed something, and he was there to fill that need. You know, I'll never, you know, ever forget that. And I bring it up to him every so often, like, you know, and just to thank him and remind him of that side of Phil in case he forgets sometimes. You know, but for me personally, you know, how does it reflect in my life? You know, what does being a Christian golfer look like? And like I told you, I mean, I'll tell you one brief story, and it kind of goes back to why I'm a Christian, really, is in the Ryder Cup at 99 at Brookline, when the U.S. won and came from four behind, there was a lot of negative press written about the U.S. team celebrating and being, you know, unsportsmanlike, and they singled me out personally as being the worst of the worst. And all of the European press wrote this thing about, hey, here's Tom Lehman, this supposed man of God who was such an unsportsmanlike dude, and he was so nasty and so cruel and so mean-spirited, and, you know, how can this guy possibly be a Christian? And this guy had written this thing in Golf World magazine, and I vowed that when I saw this guy, I was going to give him a piece of my mind. Well, I saw the guy about a month later at St. Andrews during the Dunhill Cup, and he was over on that side of the range, and I just made a beeline to this guy, and I just absolutely let him have it. I mean, I was so angry. I thought he was being so unfair to me personally, and I didn't care what I said. I didn't care what his feelings were. I just told him exactly what I thought. And again, for those of you who know me, I can be quite aggressive. And it was a really, really aggressive, unkind, unchristian, uncaring, inhuman attack on that guy. All right? And then I walked away and he walked away. Well, then time goes by. I get to be the Ryder Cup captain in 2006. Well, he writes another article. And he makes the first article look like he's talking about a choir boy. The second article was far worse. But the only difference is that this one was actually accurate. He basically quoted what I said to him word for word and put it out there for all the world to see. Okay, so think about all the things that you've wanted to say to that person you just despise. Think of all the things you'd want to say that and you didn't care how nasty it was and how much it might hurt, or whether it was true or not, but you just wanted to get it off your chest. Well, he put it all out there in letter form so the whole world could see it. And you talk about conviction. You talk about, holy crap, I can't believe I did that. And so I found his email, and I wrote him an email, and I explained, you know, I said, I haven't thought about that day in 7 years. Since the day it happened at St. Andrews until the day you wrote that, I never thought twice about that. I just read what you wrote, and all I can say was, I was really wrong. I was really wrong, and I can't believe I treated anybody that way. I can't believe I said that to you. In fact, I'll tell you right now that because I know, you say what a hypocrite I am, and of course I am. I have no defense. I am a hypocrite. You know, but we all are. You know, but I claim to be this Christian guy, and yet I'm capable of that. That's why I know I need Jesus in my life, because I am capable of the most brutal things. Without Jesus in my life, that stuff would be rampant. I do that all the time. I don't know what I would do if I didn't have somebody in my life, someone in my life, something in my life that could kind of rein me in. But even at that point, I still do stuff that I shouldn't do. But this is why I'm a Christian. This is why I'm a Christian, because I can do that, and I know how much I need Jesus' love and forgiveness in my life. And so I know that he's forgiven me. I've asked for forgiveness. But all I can say is this, is I am so sorry. Would you please find it to forgive me? We may never be friends. Maybe we will be. But I treated you so badly, and I'm totally wrong. I'm sorry. I get an email back within an hour. I absolutely forgive you. You know, when I went over for the next British Open, we got together, had lunch, had a beer. And you know what, to this day, we're friends. You know, and I think two things really happened is I think he saw the hypocrisy that we as Christians might have because we act like we're perfect. You know, and he actually appreciated the fact that I said, look, the reason I'm a Christian is because I'm so imperfect. This is why I need Jesus right here. And by the way, you do too, but we all do. But I think he finally understood maybe for the first time this idea that it's because of our imperfections and what God has done for us that we call ourselves Christians. You know, we can't get there on our own. We can't do it on our own. We can never be good enough. We need that person of Jesus Christ to kind of build that bridge for us with God. And I think that whole episode helped him to understand that. So, you know, God says he can work all things out for good for those who love him, and he certainly worked that thing out for good. You know, but how does, you know, because I know I need God in my life, you know, there's a lot more successes that way than failures. So what does it look like? So to me, you know, golf is a sport. You play it, you work at it, you compete. You can be a very tough competitor, but it doesn't mean you can't be a loving, encouraging competitor. The U.S. Open in 1996, I was playing with Steve Jones in the final round. We were tied for the lead in the final group. And he had just missed about a year and a half due to an injury. And, you know, Steve Jones is a wonderful Christian guy. Love the guy. He loves God. He's just a super-duper guy. But he was really nervous. He was even more nervous than normal because he hasn't played competitively for a while. And here he is now in the finals of the final group of the U.S. Open, tied for the lead. And so walking off the first tee, I said, look, hey, Jonesy, I want to give you a scripture. It was Joshua 1:9. Hey, be bold and strong, banish fear and doubt, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. I want you to know that is for you. So today when you play golf, and for me too, let's go out, let's be bold, let's be strong, let's have no fear, because God is with us today. And let's go show people what it looks like to be a Christian competitor. Let's just go play boldly and strongly and compete for God and do the best we can without any fear. And so we did. You know, he shot 70, I shot 71, he won by a shot. And so people, you know, in the media room was like, why would you, because then, let me retract, we got to the 16th hole, you know, all the pressure's on, we're tied, you know, it's coming right down to the wires between me and Davis Love and Steve Jones, and Davis made a couple bogeys, so he was kind of dropping out, so now it's just me and Jonesy, and so I said, look, we're doing it, okay, be bold and strong, buddy, brother, be bold and strong, banish fear and doubt, the Lord our God is with you wherever you go, so let's finish this right, let's finish this strong, like I say, and he ended up winning by a shot. And so the media were like, you know, how can you possibly do that? You know, how can you encourage a competitor like that? I'm like, well, first of all, you know, my game is up to me. You know, if I win, it's up to me. If I want to go out and bury the last three holes, I have the chance to do that. So Steve Jones has nothing to do with that. It's all about me. So if I can't go out and win, you know, that's not Steve Jones's fault. But as a Christian brother, if I'm going to see Steve Jones on the street, walking down Main Street, Alexandria, right down Broadway, would I not want to encourage Steve Jones? Sure I would. I'd want to say something nice to Steve Jones. So why can't I do the same thing in the middle of a competition? I didn't think I was going to lose. I expected to win, you know, but I certainly wanted Steve Jones to know that I wanted him to do well as well and encourage him. And so to me, that's, you can do that. You can compete hard and you can play hard and you can be committed and you can want to win and you can think you're going to win and you can still be compassionate and encouraging. You know, so I think that's one way that in my life how God's grace shows up. I think my gift is encouragement, and I try to encourage whenever I can, no matter what the situation. Another thing is in personal integrity. Personal integrity. You know, it's easy, you know, in the big stage, you know, say the right thing, you get on TV and whatever you say. Another thing is, what about when nobody's looking? You know, if nobody sees anything, who are you? What do you do? And in terms of professional golf, you know, that's a pretty big deal. I mean, you see a lot of stuff all the time about penalties being called and breaking rules and, you know, I mean, just, you know, but personal integrity is everything. And I know that I learned a big lesson when I was in seventh grade. I cheated in a golf tournament once in seventh grade, and the way I got caught was I didn't get caught, is that our team ended up winning by a shot. And because I cheated and cut a shot, our team won. And so I had to kind of live with that, you know, for a long, long time, you know, knowing that because our team won because I cheated. And you know what, seventh grade is what, 12 or 13 years old? You know, how old are you? What grade, well, how old are you? Are you 13, 12? How old are you? 9, 8, 10? Okay, so not much older than her. Just a little older than her, you know. So when you're just a little bit older than her and you get caught in something like that, and when I say caught, I'm just caught with guilt, knowing when you look at yourself in the mirror that you did something that you really, really regret. And so I vowed at age 12 or 13 that I will never, ever do something like that again. And so if you fast forward, I was playing in Greensboro. I was leading going in the final round. Second hole's a par five. I made a really good par in one, you know, almost made birdie. Number two is a par five. I knocked it on in two, about 30 feet from the hole. Rolled it up there, just past the hole, went about that far past the hole. And so all I had was a tap in. So I walked up to tap it in as I took the putter back. And right as I started coming through, it looked to me like the ball moved. Okay, right as I was about to make contact, it looked like the ball just turned. Okay, in the hole it went. I tapped it in. You know, because how do you stop in the, you know, and so I was like, you know, kind of literally kind of did one of those. And my playing partners were like, well, what was that all about? I go, well, I think the ball moved when I was making contact. No, I didn't see anything. Boy, I don't know. It looked like it moved to me. So I called the official, and they got the TV to look at it. And they looked at it on TV, and they didn't see anything. And I said, so I started, you know, so I said, you know what? You know what you see, right? You know. I mean, all of us here, we know, right? We know when, if you know you've kind of done something you shouldn't, or you can't fool your conscience. So, you know, that ball moved, okay? And it moved right before I made contact. I mean, I took the putter away, and right as I started coming through, that ball just moved forward, and I hit it as it was moving because I couldn't stop, and it went in the hole. Well, okay, it's a penalty for hitting a moving ball, and it's a penalty for not putting it back because it moved, so it was a two-shot penalty. You know, so I went from being a shot ahead to a shot behind, and ended up losing by a shot that week, you know, because, but it goes back to seventh grade. And it goes back to seventh grade saying, I will never, ever put myself in a position again to regret something good that happens if I knew that something had gone wrong and I didn't rectify it. You know, so I called that penalty on myself. And to me, that's what the personal integrity is. It's when nobody's looking, nobody sees it, nobody understands it, but you know, and you're willing to call it on yourself. So to me, that's a big way that Jesus works in my life, is that little voice that you listen to who is telling you, yes, no, don't do it, you know, or whatever it might be, and you listen. You know, and so I think the thing that kind of encapsulated the whole thing for me and into, you know, this whole thing about personal integrity and doing the right thing, and I'll close with this story, is that it affects other people. The way it affects other people when you choose to do the right thing, when you choose to do the honorable thing or just choose the right way to go. Because we don't often understand that our choices affect others. And you know, one of the reasons why God, I think, hates sin so much, how he hates the things that we do that mess up so much, is because innocent people suffer because of what we do. If we make a bad choice, innocent people will suffer for the bad choices that we make. You know, and that's one of the reasons why God hates it so much when we make the wrong choice. The innocent should never suffer, but they do. But sometimes when you make the right choice, the people are blessed that you have no idea they'll be blessed. And so this final story, I was playing in Wichita, Kansas. And I had no caddy. It was 1990. It was on the Hogan Tour, which is now the web.com tour. And I was just a part-time member. I was a conditional member. So I played in one Hogan Tour event, and it was July. So I hadn't really been on the tour at all. And so I had no caddy. I had no guy that traveled with me as my caddy. So when I got to Wichita, I went into the golf shop, and I asked the pro, is there someone here who can caddy for me? Well, you know, we don't really have caddies here, but, you know, I can probably find somebody to carry the bag for you. I go, yeah, well, you don't mind, you can find, you know, it's 6 o'clock at night. I'll be about here tomorrow at 8 o'clock in the morning. If you can have somebody here to caddy, that'd be great. And so the next morning, 8 o'clock, boom, there's a kid. 18 years old, just finished high school, kind of a stocky, strong-looking kid. Really quiet. Don't even remember his name. Remember, he was a wrestler. He had just finished high school, and he was a wrestler. He had won the state championship at his weight class in Kansas. This guy's a wrestler. I go, well, okay, you're a wrestler. This is a golf tournament. Do you know anything about golf? I'd never been on a golf course. Okay, you're not a golfer. That's fine. That's okay. You know, I can make my own decisions. Do you know anything about golf at all? Nope, don't know anything about golf. Okay, well, here's what we're going to do. You're going to be here on time. All right, you're going to carry the bag, and you're going to keep me company for the next 4 days. Okay, that's your job. Keep me company for the next 4 days. So we'll talk and we'll have fun and whatever, but so your job is to be here on time and keep me company. So how does that sound? That sounds great. Yeah, sounds good to me too. So he did that. He was there on time, and he kept me company for the next 4 days. And we had a nice time. He's a quiet guy, so I didn't learn much about him. But he was a competitor, and he was encouraging, and he was friendly, and we won the tournament. Won this tournament. Okay, so the reason it was important was the Hogan Tour, which is now the web.com, if you win, you're exempt for every tournament the rest of that year, and then for the entire next year as well. So suddenly I was in a position, which I hadn't been in a long time, where I could actually plan a schedule. I knew exactly where the tournaments were going to be for this year and next year if I needed it. And so we my wife and I and our young daughter Rachel, who was 3 months old, could actually have a life where you could kind of count on stuff and plan stuff and set a schedule, and it's like, wow, this is amazing. We won this tournament, all the stuff that goes with it, you know, it's incredible. And on top of that, I won $20,000. Okay, that's the biggest check I've ever made in my entire life. I think we had $5,000 on a credit card that we owed, and living in an apartment, and you know, $20,000 was this immense number, a huge number. And so I started thinking, well, okay, that's great, 20 grand. You know, we can sure use that. You know, got tour school coming up and all these bills we have to pay. We can get out of debt. And, oh, wait, I got to pay the caddy. You got to pay the caddy.
Huh.
What should I pay him? Well, typically, when you win a tournament, you give the caddy 10% of what you win. That's kind of an unwritten rule. It just, you're part of a team, you help the guy win, and your deal is you get 10% of what the guy makes. So, you know, 10% of 20 grand is $2,000. I'm thinking like, well, why should I give a wrestler 2,000 bucks? Pay a guy for keeping me company? That doesn't seem right. I mean, come on, that can't be. I can't do that. I mean, I can't give the guy, you know, maybe $100 a day, $400. That's probably, you'll probably be happy with that. And the more I started thinking about it, it's like, well, like, there's no rule that says the guy has to know about golf. You know, there's like this gentleman's agreement, you know, it's commonly that you pay your teammate 10%. I said, Melissa, what should I do? I mean, this guy, you know, he doesn't know anything about golf. I mean, he didn't help me at all. He just kept me company. I mean, do I give him 10%? She said, I think you got to do whatever you think is right. And so I started thinking about what's right. You know, what's right? In this situation, what is right? I decided that, you know what? He's my caddy. He's my teammate. You know, he's my right-hand man, my wingman. He's the guy out there with me. You know, I don't care if he knows golf or not. He was the guy that helped me win. He's part of the thing. I guess I got to give him 10%. So I wrote him a check for $2,000. Actually, $2,400, $100 a day plus 10%, $2,400. Then kind of forgot about it. You know, we went on to the next tournament, and life goes on. And so about 2 months go by, and I got another one of these letters in the mail, another significant letter in the mail. Hey, Tom, this is whatever his name was. You know, I just want to let you know how much I enjoyed caddying for you. It meant a lot to me. You know, we didn't really talk much. I didn't share much about me, but this is who I am. You know, I was, you know, abandoned by my father when I was pretty small, and my mom tried to raise us, you know, three jobs, two brothers. We all got into trouble, drugs, alcohol, you know, girls. Starting in 10th grade, I was just an absolute mess, kicked out of school, back in school, kicked out of school, back in school. Was kind of befriended by the wrestling coach who became a mentor to me. And he's also, by the way, he was the guy who led the FCA in Wichita, in our part of town. And started going to FCA, and you know, I ended up, you know, realizing that I needed the Lord in my life, and I accepted the Lord in my life my junior year. And I was actually quite a good wrestler, and I became the state champion my senior year. And you know, and so I went from this situation where I was going way down the wrong road, where I was now really going in the right road, and I really decided I wanted to go to Bible college. I wanted to go to this Bible college, which isn't not too far from our house. I didn't want to go far from Mom, you know, but I wanted to continue my, you know, studies at a Bible college, but I didn't have any money. You know, my mom had no money. I had no money. The tuition was $2,000. And so the money that you paid me, you know, got me to this Bible college, and I just want to let you know that it really meant a lot that I got to caddy for you, and I want you to know what that paycheck meant to me. You know, so to me, what does living the life of a Christian look like? Well, sometimes you get blessed without even realizing it, you know, but to me, I know for a fact that question is, what is the right thing, is not something that we make up on our own. The answer to that is not something we just make up on our own based upon our feelings and emotions. It's all right there in that book called the Bible. You know, that is the guidebook. That is the roadmap. And if you study it and you read it and you actually take it seriously and put it into your life to use, it will give you the answers. So the answer to do I pay this caddy 10% or not is strictly right out of the Bible, just saying you need to do the right thing, and here's why. You know, and when you do the right thing, people get blessed. You know, so that kid in that situation really helped me to understand that just like innocent folks suffer when you do the wrong thing, that people get blessed when you do the right thing. You know, and it's not my blessing, it's not your blessing, it's God's blessing. He uses people like us to bless other people because we choose to do the right thing. So my encouragement today is that in this room full of so many people who I know over the years have done so many of the right things, is that continue to do the right thing. And if you don't do the right thing, then start doing the right thing. And if you want to know how to start learning how to do the right thing, then I say, look up. God is the answer to knowing the answer to that question, what is right and what is wrong. There is a definite right and there is a definite wrong. There is absolutes in this world even though people may say there's not, there are. There are absolute truths, and there are absolute yeses, and there's absolute nos. And God has the answer to those questions. And the fruits of those yeses and the fruits of those doing the right things are something you'll never regret. So anyway, that's all I have to say. I have been blessed and honored by having you ask me to speak today. My roots are here. Everything I am in this life is because of my parents, because of those around them, my friends who influenced me, and God who used all of them, you know, in my life. So I thank you. It's me who thanks you for letting me be here and letting me be a part of this community. God bless you.
Thank you, Tom, and I like the challenge. Go live for others, okay? We hope to see you on August 18th when Dick Beardsley is here. Thank you very much.